This edition of Culture on Monocle 24 was first broadcast on the 19th of March 2012. Hello and welcome to the 23rd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we present to you the things we saw and heard at last week's South by Southwest, the world's premier music conference, slash film festival, slash media melting pot. We get an exclusive report on the hottest tips, coolest bands and rockingest launches from Austin, Texas.
This is the one festival where you get a sense of everything that's coming up and emerging musically, but also what's coming up and what big trends are on the horizon in the technology industry, and where, you know, when you understand both sides of that, you can kind of see where the future of the music industry is going.
We're also aided and abetted in our understanding of all the Austin action by Kristin Hirsch, founder of artist network Cash and formerly of indie darlings The Throwing Muses, and by John Mulvey from Uncut magazine.
The narrative of it isn't about the new bands that are discovered there, it's about the established artists that launch their next campaigns there. So this year it's Bruce Springsteen and it's Jack White launching his solo career.
We'll also take you to Vancouver's best record shop and get the skinny on Hong Kong's most cutting-edge art space.
The art scene in Hong Kong was not as developed, especially in the area of contemporary art. In some way, it does change the scenes of Hong Kong, because without the energy of our group, we can't start space like this.
That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. But before all that, here's a song from my album of the week, One Second of Love, by Night Jewel, and this is the title track. A little bit of LA noir there from Night Jewel. That was One Second of Love from the album of the same name. Now, the South by Southwest Festival has just come to an end in Austin, Texas, after 10 days of revelry across interactive media, film, and most famously, music. That, after all, is where it all started. Our reporter, Mar Sellers, was there to soak up all the action and get a sense of the underground music scene in Austin itself.
Downtown's definitely the epicenter, but it's moved east quite a bit. Everything is going on all over the city at once. You know, if there's some, you know, cafe, you know, 15 minutes out of downtown, they're probably having bands right now. They're probably having two stages, you know.
After I arrive in Austin, my first stop is a pawn shop to buy a $25 bike. This is the best $25 I will spend all week. It's getting from A to B in Austin is tricky, as the buses only run about every half hour. There aren't nearly enough cabs for the extra few 100,000 people that come to the city. I spoke to the local bike shop worker, Rob, an Austin native, about how the festival impacts his town each year.
So the thing that's weird about it is that, I don't know, it just kind of impacts the town really quickly all at once and then leaves, and everybody gets really into the town and gets this like feeling about the town, and it's not really true, and it just kind of creates this sort of disposable thing that happens really quickly all at once and then it just goes away.
My name's Chad Allen and I run Switched On Music Electronics. South by Southwest brings in, yeah, just lots of people with lots of money, which is good for doing business. I run a music store, so thousands of bands means, you know, thousands of bands coming into my shop, hopefully.
Yeah, can you explain, like, the sounds in the background? What do you sell?
I sell mostly synthesizers, drum machines, electronic musical instruments, that kind of stuff.
How much more business do you get during this week?
It's packed nonstop this, you know, for over 7 days during the festival, which is great.
It's a good week for you.
It's our biggest week of the year. Bigger than Christmas.
My next stop was the Canadian Blast Barbecue, where I caught up with Steve Pratt from Canada, who had been attending all the interactive events.
My name's Steve Pratt. I'm the director of digital music for CBC, which is Canada's public broadcaster. I planned my schedule at South by Southwest to bridge the best of the interactive part and the music part. My job is around digital music, so it's kind of a nice combination of interactive and music. And this is the one festival where you get a sense of everything that's coming up and emerging musically, but also what's coming up and what big trends are on the horizon in the technology industry, and where, you know, when you understand both sides of that, you can kind of see where the future of the music industry is going.
Outside the Mint Records party, in the back patio of Headhunters, I bumped into Radio 1 presenter Jen Long, who's been coming to the festival for 6 years.
I've always wanted to go. I'd heard it's just, you know, 4 or 5 days of parties and bands that you'd always wanted to see, and like, I came and it was a completely fulfilled prophecy where you're gonna get hit by a bus. Oh! Where I just had the best time, and like, everyone was so much fun. I saw so many people, met so many people.
Do you think you will ever miss a year?
I've sort of been thinking recently that it's kind of become really busy now, and like, a lot less of my friends who used to come are kind of coming out here, because it's not so much about like discovering bands and kind of like the industry side anymore. It's a lot more about just being a festival and loads of people just like kind of having a party and having fun. So it's kind of lost what initially attracted me to the festival, but every year I'm like, oh, maybe I won't go next year, and then he always ended up coming back. Unless I was broke, I don't think I'd miss a year.
I caught up with Ben, a booking agent from Cologne, at a German barbecue.
Actually, I met a lot of German people here that I never met in Germany that I'm doing stuff now with. But also like the interactive scene, it was really interesting to meet some interactive people that are running new stuff that's way better than Twitter or all the stuff that's really like known. Like, I met two guys yesterday. One thing is a guy from New York. He's running this thing called Vibe, which is kind of an anonymous, anonym in German. They don't know who's tweeting kind of thing, and the Occupy movement is using that stuff.
Anonymous.
Yeah, anonymous. The Occupy movement is using this tool because to get together and connect.
So it's all interesting and important. The networking, the new technologies, the free booze, the free food. But what was everyone's favorite band?
Gaga Kuris. This Japanese two-piece that is a guitar and drums, and they're like Boris crossed with Lightning Bolt.
I really liked Airbird last night. They played our showcase, and I hadn't heard of them before, and they were terrific. I think it might have been their first show or something. I don't know. That's what someone told me. They're from New York. Yeah. Airbird from New York.
The best new act I've seen so far is Caveman. Saw the other day, who I really liked. I just like these guys now, which is really good. We called, it's a Chain Reaction.
Chains of Love.
Chains of Love, who we just saw, we heard about. Somebody had seen the other day, so we came to see them.
The band I want to see the most down here is a Canadian band who has a great new album. I haven't seen them perform it live yet. Is Plants and Animals. They have a great new album called The End of That, and I saw them a few years ago. A fantastic live band. I can't wait to see them down here.
I've seen a lot of cool bands so far, like Matthew Deer with his live band was pretty awesome at the Pitchfork Sing. Light Asylum was cool. DOCs, of course. Coma from Cologne, really tight live electro duo. They're really cool. But yeah, it's day one, so that's what I've seen so far.
It's the day after South by Southwest, and the streets are empty, and Austin residents are coming out of their houses again to take back their city. I'm going to take a really long nap and drink some herbal tea to try and recover my voice until next year, when we all go through this again. For Monocle and Austin, I'm Mar Sellers.
To give us a bit of perspective on how the event has evolved over the years, I sat down far away from the throng of wristband-hungry music journalists in the comfort of Midori House with the deputy editor at Uncut magazine, John Mulvey. He's torn off some strips of the festival in his time and came in to explain how it all works.
I think the last time I went, I managed to see about 60 bands in 4 days.
Wow. What does this require then? Talk us through the kit you need to see 60 bands in 4 days. You need a notebook and some stout walking shoes.
Stout walking shoes.
That's sexy. That's rock and roll.
Yeah, I think maybe. What you need ideally is a hotel downtown, which if you book as late as I usually do, you don't get, and are consequently somewhere on the ring road about 10 miles out of town and dependent on trying to get a cab at about 11:30 in the morning with everyone else in the same position, and therefore don't get there till about 1:30, 2:00. At which point you start going to all the parties. You start trying to get the wristbands for all the exclusive parties. There are various things like things that Spin do and Fader do, which are wristband only parties. So you'll go through the parties for the afternoon. Then ideally you'll go and chill out at your hotel for a couple of hours after the party's finished and before the evening showcases start. And by the end of it, you can normally see if you've got good stamina and you've got the right passes and you actually don't want to really do that much mingling and just want to see as many bands as you can get to see 15 or 20 bands a day.
And it's presumably it's quite a competitive field. Is it all about being the first to notice? Is it still about picking the trends? Is that South by Southwest still about
well,
that?
Well, it certainly used to be. I'm slightly unsure about what it is now. I was exchanging some messages with a friend the other day who was also as bitter and jealous about not being there as I was. And I was basically saying, you know, like, don't tell anybody, you know, the general attitude this year and for the past few years has been, don't tell anybody about this amazing band, apart from everybody that you speak to and everybody that follows you on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever. There's this kind of, it's a very kind of compromised secrecy, I think, at this point. But
this is like the equivalent, I suppose, of writing in a travel magazine, this is the best kept secret in Sardinia or something. And it's like, and you're like,
absolutely,
keep this band under
yeah.
wraps because we want them to be a fans band. And then, of course, they go mega. I mean, is South by Southwest good at that? I mean, has it historically been good at launching bands, or is it a sort of curated launch? Is there always someone behind it, or do things spring out of nowhere?
I think increasingly it's curated. I mean, originally it felt a lot more spontaneous. The first time I went was 2000, and it would be disingenuous of me to suggest that it was this kind of raw, kind of unmediated festival, but because it certainly wasn't. But there was a sense that actually there might be a band who would play on Wednesday night, who would then be invited to play a couple of parties on Thursday afternoon, who would then play three or four parties on Friday and Saturday, and would then get, from a position of no one having really heard of them, would then get a big money deal, or certainly get a bunch of fairly avaricious A&Rs chasing them by the end of Saturday. That model would actually happen. But I think in common with a lot of the rest of the music business, it's very hard to kind of be unknown these days,
right.
Basically. I kind of think, like this year, the buzz band before the festival was a band from LA called Bleached. There's two sisters. It's slightly bewildering to me because it because of my great age and jaded experience, they sound like a bunch of fairly winsome and effete indie bands from about 1984. That was the buzz last night when I was checking Twitter and finding out exactly who everyone was talking about on the ground there, that they did seem to be the ones. But it, you know, this is hardly an unknown band. You do a bit of rudimentary research, as I did this morning before I came in, just to find out about them. The first mentions of them on a lot of prominent blogs were last summer, perhaps earlier. If you search for for videos of them, there are several up already, one of which seems to be fairly prominently hosted by Urban Outfitters, which does that exactly kind of characterise them as this great unknown band that no one has ever discovered before. I remember one year I was there, there was this band called Tapes and Tapes with a hot band of the week. You're shaking you're nodding your head as if you actually remember who they
I think there is something. I think this is one of those things that comes up when you put your iPod on shuffle and you go, who are Tapes and Tapes?
It was one of those classic South by Southwest moments where everyone you would talk to was going, have you seen Tapes and Tapes? Have you seen Tapes and Tapes? And about halfway through the week, it transpired that XL, you know, who obviously have had massive success with Adele and Jet White and Vampire Weekend and lots of other things, and subsequently had signed them. So the even more interest kind of generated around them. I finally tracked them down towards the end of the week at a party at about 1 o'clock in the morning to see what all the fuss was about, and was just so massively underwhelmed by the whole experience. Their album came out again on XL. I mean, a few months later, did adequately, and then they were dropped pretty soon after. I think they're still going, but there's a lot of kind of cautionary tales like that. Another example, 2005 is quite an interesting year because I can't remember anyone that actually broke that year genuinely big, but I can remember some fairly bizarre. There was a band called Love Is All. One more time. a huge pursuit around them. Their album had already come out on a small American label called What's Your Rupture, which was pretty hip out of New York at the time, and had been on sale in the UK and had done okay on import sales. I knew the distributor who found the whole situation hilarious because he'd been selling through okay on it. There was this massive pursuit of them, which I think was eventually won by Parlophone, who, rumour had it, spent about £750,000 to secure the rights to release that album, which had already been out in the UK.
I feel they might have done their research.
Well, I'm sure someone did their research, but certainly in the past, a certain kind of critical mass accumulated around some bands, which translated into a mania, which translated in fairly insane amounts of money being chucked about on projects which were never going to actually recoup. And that would be a case in point. You know, the record came out. They spent, you know, the best part of £750,000 on securing that record, put it out. Virtually everyone that had wanted it had already bought it on import on a much hipper, smaller, cachet boutique label. And then they scuttled off and disappeared, you know.
Is that one of the lessons of South by Southwest, that it needs to have that vibe, it needs to have that edginess, even if it's only the reputation of edginess, it sort of needs boutique idea.
Yeah, to some degree, you know, I'm aware that I'm just telling cautionary tales here, really, but I think there are so many. There was a period about 5 years ago where everyone from the British music business went out there, including so many no hope British bands, that basically seemed to be under the assumption that if they spent several thousand pounds shipping themselves off to South by Southwest, managed to secure a gig at 7 p.m. in a hotel lounge somewhere on the outskirts of the festival, they would automatically be picked up because they would be seen. Of course, the intense naivety of that, when actually there are 200 other bands jostling for the delegates to actually go and see them at precisely the same time slot, meant that they'd be lucky to get 15 people there.
And is that how?
And
is
so
that,
they would have spent all that money, absolutely in vain, because people do their research. Yeah. They did their research back in the day, and they certainly do it now. That, you know, all that music is so available.
I was going to say that was what I wanted to move on to. Yeah. That idea of it's so available, the music by the bands themselves, biogs of bands, links to this, that, and everything else.
Yeah,
that's so much more available now than it was 10 years ago. Does that sort of spoil the surprise of South by Southwest? Does South by Southwest sort of have to move a lot faster to still be interesting and relevant?
Well, I think South by Southwest have countered that in two ways. One, they've got kind of bigger.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is a ludicrous culture of queuing there, whereby if there are certain shows that you want to go to, like, say, I imagine the Bruce Springsteen show last night, which was fairly ecstatically received. He did the keynote speech and played a gig last night. And I imagine you probably had to queue for about 3 days to actually get a wristband into that show, unless there was some kind of ticketing opportunity. I don't quite know how that worked, but they basically are shipping in more and more big names so that it becomes less of a new music showcase. Well, it still is a new music showcase, but the stories of South by Southwest don't become... The narrative of it isn't about the new bands that are discovered there. It's about the established artists that launch their next campaigns there. So this year it's Bruce Springsteen and it's Jack White launching his solo career there.
This is a really different thing, presumably, for South. It's quite a departure for the festival to be doing this, right? I mean, I guess...
They've always done it, but yeah. it just becomes more prominent. I mean, I remember a few years ago seeing a keynote speech by Neil Young, which was pretty nice and quite interesting. I love Neil Young. You know, sitting in a room watching Neil Young have a chat to a journalist was quite pleasant. Now, of course, Bruce Springsteen does the keynote yesterday. It's broadcast live across the internet so that, you know, everyone who's interested in Springsteen can be following it live rather than the 500 delegates in that room at the conference centre.
And that's the thing. Do you still need to be there to really know what's going on?
I'm conscious that maybe I've sounded a little cynical thus far in the interview, and maybe what we're not talking about is the sheer exhilaration of actually being there and being admittedly jostled by thousands of other music journalists from all over the planet, but also as being part of this kind of very hungry community. It's quite, like I say, you can be very cynical about it, but equally at the same time, and you can also be quite jaded about this idea that everyone is looking for the next big thing. But at the same time, you can also be excited by the fact that there are a lot of people who are as excited about hearing new music as you are.
Yeah.
And also there remains, especially if you're interested in genuinely underground music, which never has that kind of ever ever has a potential for that kind of commercial imperative, which we're talking about, but is happy to exist on a much more kind of subterranean level. It's fantastic. And I remember one year I ended up finding some guys had driven a bus from, I think, California with the generator built in and basically parked it in the back of a Mexican restaurant somewhere on the, so it's kind of the barrio section of town, and sort of built a little stage in front of it and were putting bands on there around kind of late afternoon for a few hours every day. And I used to, after the parties, most of the parties had finished in the afternoon and before the show started in the evening, I'd go and hang out there. And it was a great, really casual atmosphere, and it was never a place where you were going to see the next big thing, but it was a place where you were going to see some interesting music.
That was John Mulvey of Uncut magazine. We also managed to touch base with the equally experienced, though somewhat more chilled, Kristin Hirsch, former lead singer of The Throwing Muses, who's at the event itself. She's a South by Southwest regular and is now trying to lend a hand to aspiring artists through Cash Music, an online music platform which helps musicians establish themselves without record labels and middlemen. She spoke to me from what she described as a shabby motel, in true rock and roll style.
Do you think South by Southwest is a kind of good bellwether for the state of recorded music and the live stuff? Because obviously most people go, I guess, it's still got its main reputation is as a place to check out new bands in kind of in a place where everyone's there. Does it still have that reputation? I mean, when you're out, is it still exciting being out at night, having beers and going from venue to see groups?
Not for me. because...
Come on, you can't spend too much time in that motel room, Kristin.
It's so nice, though.
I know.
I just don't buy that this is where you hear new music or music that matters. I think I have a lot of faith in musicians to hide out and become special and then try to find their way in the world, but that's when my faith sort of falls because I don't think the world always meets up with them and celebrates what's good. Instead, they celebrate what's loudest, what's showing off the most. And now that's affecting what it feels like to walk around here at night and hear the bands playing. I don't hear special as much as I used to.
What about on the panel? You are the conscience of that panel. You've said so yourself. You can't go back on that. When you ask people if they're evil, what do you generally feel is their response?
I think that if you're engaging in a product, and they're usually selling, sometimes they're facilitating, but I think you should know your product. And there are many businesses where this is not important, but in food and music, it is. I think they sometimes engage in lowest common denominator marketing, and that can make you fast money, but it hurts people. And I don't think you have returning customers. I don't think that you engage passion at that point. And passion lasts for years and years, sometimes lifetimes, so I think it's ultimately a better business decision to make, but they're more interested in initial profits and getting off the ground, and I just want to keep that urge in check so that they do last and they do something that matters.
And maybe you can tell us then about the coalition of artists and stakeholders. You're on the board of this. This acronymizes perfectly as CASH. Is that a word? I don't know. So this is CASH, and you're one of the co-founders of it, Kristin. This aims to do some of the stuff you've been talking about, presumably. Maybe you can give us a bit of a, shine a little bit of light on CASH.
I started CASH as a non-profit with a few friends to help musicians circumvent the traditional recording industry, which was collapsing at the time. And I needed a solution. I knew others did as well. Ultimately, we have come to be like WordPress is for bloggers. We are for musicians. We offer free software tools that they own. They're on their servers. They own forever. No one can take them away. And it doesn't matter how much money you have, which I think is really important when it comes to music, because throughout time, musicians have, the honest ones have passed the hat, and it can be an honest way of life. We just forget that because rock stars happened. And if rock stars aren't going to happen anymore, which would be great, we still need music.
That was Kristin Hirsch. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and we're back with another treat of a tune after this.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design hour. It's a show about the things that we live with. Join us as we take you on a tour of the finest furniture, buildings and fashion from around the world. From ramshackle warehouses to luxury runways, hard hat construction sites to the safety of the studio, we bring you the people and products that fill our lives.
These people find a common ground, and you know if they do that you're probably onto something that everybody in the world might be able to agree with.
Tune in each week to hear about the things that make life better. That's Section D, premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24. And before we abandon South by Southwest for another year, let's say goodbye in the only way we know how. As recommended by John Mulvey, this is from Bruce Springsteen's new album, Wrecking Ball, We Take Care of Our Own. And that was Bruce Springsteen on pretty vintage form, right down to the 1980s fade out at the end there. That was We Take Care of Our Own from his new album, Wrecking Ball. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. And still to come in part two, we'll be getting under the cover of Frankie magazine in Melbourne, exploring Hong Kong's Cattle Depot Arts District, asking what people are filling their ears with in Vancouver, and hearing what happened when we left Monocle's managing editor alone with some recording equipment in our sonic 60-second soundscape. Sweet thing. Now off we trot to Australia to take a peek at the pages of one of our favourite women's fashion magazines called Frankie. Hang on. Is it a fashion magazine? Well, kind of. It also parades its rootsy and intelligent aesthetic on culture, food, retail and travel. And all on good stock paper pickers. Reporter Irene Scott sat down with the magazine's founder and editor, Joe Walker, in Melbourne to learn a bit more about the title.
I feel like I'm sitting in the middle of Frankie magazine. Mick Jagger's on the wall. There's a knitted cactus in the corner, adorable art all over the place, and quite conveniently, I'm sitting next to the editor of Frankie, Joe Walker. Hi, Joe.
It's a cute explosion.
I've got to say, I did expect this to be a bit more organised chaos. This is actually quite actually organised.
I did actually clean before you came in. You know, it's sort of like random stuff. You put it in a pile, suddenly it's all organised.
Genius. Let's talk about the magazine. So when did Frankie magazine start?
Frankie started almost 7 years ago. It was two ladies in Queensland called Louise Bannister and Lara Burke. We've been going for a while now, just hitting our stride, I feel.
What's the story behind Frankie, though? Why did they decide that the magazine market in Australia needed something like Frankie?
I think it was looking at the newsstands and looking at the usual sort of rubbish that is aimed towards women in the magazine market. And, you know, we all know what I'm talking about there. Everything with 50 ways to please your man, unaffordable fashion. And I think that they just looked at what was out there and thought, where's the magazine that speaks to us and to our friends, and maybe a lot of good inventions are born out of frustration. I'm not quite sure. It is actually easier to say what it isn't rather than what it is. Remember in High Fidelity when John Cusack was explaining how to make a mixtape and you've got to have different kinds of songs and then you've got to like really step it up for the second song and then bring it down for the second, for the third. I always quite like to think of it like that. So in terms of, you know, you've got your slow songs, so we do things like recipes and DIY and craft and all that kind of stuff. Then you've got your party songs. A lot of really good Australian writers do opinion pieces for us that are normally very funny, interesting, design, artists, fashion, all that kind of thing. I actually read an online review that I think was actually trying to slag us off that said, Frankie is like the last bastion of 90s slacker Gen X culture or something like that. And it was said in quite a snarky tone, but then I thought, actually, no, I quite take that as a compliment because I think we have an ethos of individuality. We don't care if you make huge amounts of money and you wear secondhand clothes. I do actually work from home a fair bit. So a fair proportion of Frankie gets made from my couch in a little suburb in North Melbourne called Brunswick. Just quietly, a lot of it also gets done while I'm wearing pajamas. We have, I think, about 5,000 copies going overseas every issue. UK is a big market for us, New Zealand, and then North America, Northern Europe, say around Sweden, Denmark, that kind of region, and also Southeast Asia.
Because when I read Frankie, it screams to me of Melbourne or someone living in Brisbane. How does that translate to someone who's living in, for instance, Helsinki?
I think that that is part of the charm of Frankie, is the laid-back approach, which I think probably a lot of people associate with Australia. What I think of as a slight rat bag element, which is acknowledging that women, while they want to wear pretty clothes, can also swear like troopers and be funny. And I think that that kind of laid back, a little bit scrappy around the edges, tiny bit of attitude, I think that that's the bit that really a lot of readers in Australia and overseas, I think that that's what they really like.
Which makes sense if you're looking at, you know, the women's magazine market. If you've got the ones that tell you how to have sex and then you've got the other ones that tell you how to buy really expensive fashion and are very serious and you have to frown a lot when you read them, it does sit somewhere, I don't know, it's not really in the middle, but it sits somewhere else to those.
It sits somewhere off to the side in the corner having a sneaky beer while everyone else is sipping on champagne and reading chick lit. We have a fair idea of who our people are. For instance, we know that 1 in 4 of our readers is male. We tend to think of our readers as being 20s and 30s, but it's more about an attitude rather than an age bracket. I mean, to give you an example, in terms of letters to the editor, the youngest one I know of that I have received a letter from is 12 and the oldest one is 89. So, as I say, it's more about sort of a lifestyle and an attitude rather than a specific age bracket.
The magazine does focus a lot on design within it, but the design of the magazine itself is, you know, quite striking, a lot of pastel colours. And how did you design the look of the magazine?
Our creative director, Lara Burke, has been on board since the original idea, which probably happened over some cheap red wine somewhere and some cigarettes in someone's backyard. So it's always really been her vision. Even though we change it up every now and then, I think that there is a strong Frankie aesthetic. If you flip through the magazine, there's a lot of white space. We have a lot of illustrations, a lot of art, a lot of design, as you said, that we feature in the magazine. A really simple, spacious, elegant kind of layout is really what works best for that kind of stuff. And also, the girl on the front cover communicates a lot of what Frankie is about, because the way we style them, and we always try to choose models who look a little bit kooky, a little bit left of centre.
What is the future for Frankie? Where to from here?
World domination? I'm not really quite sure. Obviously, the internet plays a larger role now in what we do, but I think really what we do best is stuff on paper. We also do some kind of special projects under the Frankie banner. So we have cookbooks, interior design book, we put out calendars, we put out diaries, basically anything you can put on paper. That's our bag. I know it sounds a little bit old-fashioned, but that's what we do well. So that's always going to be our main goal.
So world domination through paper.
Yes. Until the last tree is felled, that will be our world domination.
That was Joe Walker, founder and editor of Frankie magazine, talking to Irene Scott there in Melbourne. Now it's time for the sound of a city delivered via a great independent record store. Today we're off to Vancouver, where reporter Cale Judy went to meet the cool cats behind Red Cat Records.
Hi, I'm Lasse Ludic, co-owner of Red Cat Records from Vancouver, BC. So Red Cat Records was started almost 9 years ago by Amy and Andrew, who kind of part of the local music scene and art scene. And about 5 years ago, myself and Dave bought the shop from them after they moved off to the bush. I think one of the biggest things about our shop to begin with was Buddy, who you'll see prominently displayed in a big painting on our wall, who was the resident cat that used to live here, and later made famous by Ry Cooter on one of his albums. It's a long story, but saw the cat and loved it. Red Cat customers are a varied breed. We have everyone from the kids that are coming in and buying the latest electronic hip-hop type 7 inches, and to the people that really, really want to find that really rare Wishbone Ash album, or people that just want to buy the 99-cent records in the back. There's people that range in ages from, you know, in the 60s right down to the to teenagers that are getting into vinyl. It's really amazing, actually. So we got a huge cross-section of people in here, and yeah, it's a lot of fun. They're all very, very different. Like I said previously, a lot of customers come here for very different things. We have people that come every week and head right to the used CD section and go through that, and they don't even look at anything else. And we have huge contingents of people that just come in and buy the newest indie band and head out the door too. Something that Red Cat, that is very important to Red Cat and has been since we started, has been to be good to customers and to provide a place that people can come and hang out and be comfortable and talk about music, whether it's electronic or punk or rock and roll, or even if you want to talk about Celine Dion, we'd be happy to do it. It's something for everybody, and music has no boundaries, and everybody loves something, and we would never pass judgment on people. And I think that's something that makes Red Cat really unique, is that our goal is to make anyone who comes in here happy when they go out and to have something that they will want to listen to when they go home. We also sell some refurbished record players and amplifiers and speakers that we try to keep cheap, and just so that people have a chance to try out vinyl and see what it's like. An album that I've been really excited about is by a person called The Caretaker, and the name of the album is An Empty Bliss Beyond This World. And it's just like a guy that found a bunch of 78s, took a 78 player and plunked it in the middle of a giant warehouse and turned it on with ballroom dancing 78s, and then just added a bunch of reverb and some minor kind of electronic effects, and it's fantastic, especially on the Vancouver rainy days.
Lovely stuff. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We're off to a Chinese cattle depot to soak up some culture just after this.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now we're off to Hong Kong, to the Cattle Depot, where some of the city's alternative arts organisations have decided to set up shop. Our Hong Kong editor, Liv Levichnik, popped by for a visit to see what the space is all about.
We're at Cattle Depot, located close to the old Kai Tak Airport in Hong Kong's Kowloon. Built in 1908 for the keeping of cattle, the collection of red brick buildings is today home to an artist's village. One of the organizations calling Cattle Depot home is 1A Space. It has been active in the city's art scene for over a decade. Choi Yan Chi is founder of 1A Space.
The art scene in Hong Kong was not as, I would like to say, as developed I mean, especially in the area of contemporary art. Okay, I think, you know, even the concept of contemporary art was very unclear at that time. So once when we started, and then it in some way it does change the scenes of Hong Kong, but then actually that was the situation of Hong Kong art then, because without the energy of our group and without, you know, our experience out there, you know, we can't start space like this. I guess the change is a lot more young artists coming. At the same time, I think the commercial art market in Hong Kong is really growing. We start to show very established artists. And then even the last show, we were also a tribute to another well-established artist in Hong Kong. And then next year, we're going to have a major project on we call Kai Tak River, which is more about art and ecology and city development.
Pioneering the early contemporary art scene in Hong Kong, 1A Space has over the years brought to attention local artists and has invited international talent to exhibit in the city. Curator Davina Lee walked us through the recent 1A Space exhibition, One Suitcase Per Person.
It features three artists, David Dow, Ken Lam and Hiram Toe. The three of these artists, what they have in common is the fact that they've either were born overseas, away from Hong Kong and China, or else they spent a substantial part of their life outside Asia. And the exhibition, in a nutshell, is basically how each of these artists has developed a different strategy in relation to identity, stemming from their experiences of living outside, living as part of a minority in another country, and how they've had to deal with the pressures that are placed upon people who are strangers in someone else's country. We have the work of David Dow, who's a very well-established artist based in New York. He's been described as a legendary abstract modernist, but even so, he's still very nice guy, accessible guy. perhaps the keystone to this series of paintings is this image here. It's a painting with the words Da Hen Li House, and it's a short description of the thinking behind the series. It says, I lived there until I was six. When I returned to Chengdu 30 years later, it had just been demolished. There are no photographs. The only certain scale to rub up against my memories was the tennis court. I have since uncovered ciphers of its having been. And so this whole series is based around the dimensions of the tennis court, and it basically is a timeline of the house and all the different events, and it explains how his family had to leave China in 1949 because of the Civil War. The title of the show is taken from David's painting, One Suitcase Per Person, which is the sign that he remembers seeing at the airport when they were leaving. The only thing that they could take with them was one suitcase.
Leaving the silent exhibition building behind us, we step out into the courtyard of Cattle Depot. Though the sound of Kowloon's busy traffic climbs over the stone walls, it's a calm haven in the madness that is one of the world's most densely populated areas. It's a space that should be watched by all those interested in the development of Hong Kong's art scene. The artists, designers and theatre groups working from here make sure that Cattle Depot is constantly evolving. Don't miss 1A Space's upcoming exhibition by Korean video artist Shang Jin Lee. In Hong Kong for Monocle, I'm Liv Levichnik.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Time is almost up, but there's always time for a special minute with us. Well, actually, this week it's with David Michon, Monocle 24's managing editor. We left him alone with a microphone and recorder and the challenge of amusing and confusing us. Here's what he created for his 1 minute of sound. That was a minute of terror and simultaneous joy from Monocle's David Mishan. So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be going Arabic, Emirati and Levantine as we check out the cultural scene in the Middle East. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, helped along the way by Tom Hall, Hannah Jenkins and Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from my album of the week, 1 Second of Love, new by Night Jewel. This is She's Always Watching You. Thanks for tuning in.